All right, thanks a lot for having me here. It's a nice workshop and the opportunity to speak. So I'm going to tell you a lot more about some work we've been doing that's actually spanned the last 5 or 6 years, mostly done at UC Irvine, and also all done in conjunction with Steve White, who you heard from this morning, about taking DMRG, which is, you know, already a very useful method for lattice models, and then thinking about various ways, you know, thinking through in detail how to apply it to continuous systems first in 1D, and then very recently in 3D, which we'll tell you about. And I want to also thank the Simons Foundation for a lot of support through supporting the iTensor software that we used and all this research. So, you know, as we heard this morning a bit, you know, our motivation is that you know, we get very comfortable sometimes just studying lattice models and thinking about the qualitative side of condensed matter. But you know, if you actually, you know, walk out of the room that you often will spend your time in at March meeting and just go down the hall and kind of see like what are people mostly talking about, right? If you go to like other parts of the building at March meeting, you'll actually see, you know, this kind of physics much more being in the focus. You'll see lots of talks about DFT and other methods that can really, you know, deal with all the messiness of the real continuum. And of course, quantum chemistry, people, you know, are essentially interested in systems that live in the continuum. So you know, in our field, we're in this position of luxury where we know our theory of everything. We know what our job is, right, which is to really ultimately come back and reckon with all this continuum physics, right? So this is our theory of everything. This is the Hamiltonian where you have electrons, nuclei, and then you have Coulomb interactions between all of them. This is the nucleus-nucleus repulsion, electron-electron repulsion, and then you have the attraction of the electrons to the protons. So this, you know, deceptively simple-looking Hamiltonian describes much of our everyday world. You know, things like band gaps of semiconductors, things like, you know, melting points of different solids, things like that, and, you know, quantum chemistry, which is very important. And I found this nice article from 2000 by Laughlin and Pines kind of reflecting on the fact that we already know what our problem is and then what are the implications of that. Now, this problem is, you know, much too complicated in general most of the time. So very commonly, you make a simplification called the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. And that's where you essentially take advantage of the fact that the mass of the nucleus is much, much bigger than of a single electron. So you treat the nuclei as classical. You can still you know, let them move, but you sort of decouple them from the quantum mechanics of the electrons. Then you set the position of the nuclei. So you just treat that as fixed, and that generates a background potential that the electrons move in. And then you just have this problem, this many-body problem of electrons repelling, and here's the kinetic energy, and then the potential that they feel. So this is often referred to with this jargon name of electronic structure problem. And still, you know, an extremely complicated problem that describes a lot of interesting physics and chemistry. So just to give you an example of one particular problem that people, you know, would like to solve better and already have solved in some simple cases, but are still, you know, working very hard to solve, even this very simple electronic structure problem. One example of an electronic structure problem is the binding curve, or just the energy of a diatomic molecule, where the spacing between the nuclei is fixed at a separation of r, but then you vary r, you know, you choose different r, and you get the ground state energy of this molecule in the kind of most realistic continuum setup that you can afford to do, or that you can pull off. So an example would be like an H2 molecule, but also you might want to study the like chromium-2 molecule, which is very, very, very challenging to do. It has lots of core electrons, it has lots of entanglement, some kind of very complicated bonding going on. So there's still some open questions here in terms of, you know, making computational methods able to deal with even this simple task. And then you might want to know, if you're used to lattice models and you're used to conceptual, more kind of conceptual problems, you might want to know, why do we want this energy? Why is that the quantity we want as a function of r? And just to give you an idea of, you know, what kind of information could already be in this simple curve, just E as a function of r, you can already answer questions like, what is the equilibrium bond length of this molecule, just by looking at the position of the minimum. You can also ask, you know, how much energy would I have to supply to break this bond? And you can also even model the low energy vibration spectrum. So you can say, you know, what are some kind of low energy excitations of this molecule just by, you know, treating the bottom of this minimum as a quadratic and then doing like a harmonic oscillator approximation. So there's a lot you can get out of just this simple kind of energy as a function of our curve. So this is just to give you a kind of a feel for like a kind of a problem like a quantum chemist might ask. You know, a condensed matter person wanting to do an ab initio problem might study some big solid, you know, but they still have to reckon with the continuum. So So, you know, we're working on, you know, applying the DMRG to more and more interesting problems, and we wanted to think about applying it to continuum systems. And then you might also ask, okay, we're convinced continuum systems are interesting, but don't we already have, you know, methods like DFT, or when you're dealing with, you know, correlations and things, you know, don't you already have, you know, coupled cluster and various flavors of quantum Monte Carlo, like diffusion Monte Carlo? But it's worth thinking through, even though, you know, many of you here like DMRG and tensor networks, it's worth thinking through, you know, what are some advantages that DMRG brings to the table that can be helpful for any problem, and especially for these, you know, electronic structure problems, right? So one of them is that when you successfully pull off a DMRG calculation, you can very often get the answer to very high accuracy and not have to deal with like statistical errors, which can be very, very painful to sort of beat down. This kind of 1/√ of number of samples can just be very, very painful. So it can be very nice to just have that high accuracy. A very key one is that you can just directly access many observables, because if you succeed in the calculation, you have the wave function sitting on your computer, then you can just start extracting lots of really useful information. And that's non-trivial. I mean, if you really study Monte Carlo, a lot of effort goes into designing observables, figuring out, you know, tricks to get useful observables out of the Monte Carlo. So here you don't have as much of that problem. But probably the most important one in terms of, you know, near-term applications is DMRG's ability to handle strong correlation, right? So a lot of methods that deal with continuum systems are built around Slater determinants. And so people talk about some kind of reference system, and then you want to, you know, generate a bunch of excitations around some kind of Slater determinant, or maybe two Slater determinants. And in that picture, strong correlation appears as this problem where you just have this like proliferation of Slater determinants, just this huge number of determinants, and it just gets really hard to work with. And so DMRG just doesn't really have that problem. I mean, you know, strong correlation can make problems hard for other reasons, but DMRG is extremely good at dealing with this issue of strong correlation. And then finally, kind of looking into the future, if you can get DMRG working or tensor network methods working on these kind of problems, they have nice capabilities of accessing excited state, doing finite temperature simulations, doing dynamics. I mean, this is still challenging even for lattice models, but something to think about in the future. So a number of years ago, we were, you know, wanting to start thinking about applying DMRG to continuum problems. So we did something that I think is pretty natural to do. Since DMRG is a 1D method, we said, let's start rather simple, and let's not think about the 3D continuum yet, but let's just think about problems, quantum problems, kind of things like the electronic structure problem, but in the 1D continuum. Okay, and then the idea here is that, you know, this isn't going to be something we can directly carry to an experiment, but you know, maybe a cold atoms experiment, but not to not to a real material. But what it's going to do is serve as a toy universe for us to think about principles of solving electronic structures. So, you know, fundamental questions about, like, you know, what can you say or not say from a DFT calculation? If you do a DFT calculation, you get this funny output of like a non-interacting system. What is that non-interacting system, right? Is it, you know, what are its properties and what bearing do they have on the original interacting system, for example? And so you can ask those questions in the 1D continuum and still learn a lot, even though your systems are not the real 3D systems you'd like to study. So this is just a little cartoon of how I would see one of those 1D continuum problems. So just electrons moving in a line, feeling some kind of potential, and then still interacting with some kind of, you know, not on-site interaction, some kind of, you know, finite range or long range interaction. Okay, so about the interaction, we can't just directly take the Coulomb interaction from 3D and just treat it as a 1D interaction. It turns out there's a long history of people studying that problem in 1D, and it's extremely pathological in 1D. I encourage you actually to go and look at some of the papers. It's like people would try to figure out even the behavior of just two electrons interacting with this interaction in 1D, and then, you know, there'll be a PRL explaining what happens finally, and then someone else will write one a few years later saying, no, that one was all wrong. It's actually this other scenario. It's like really complicated. It's really not a good use of time because these are just toy systems anyway. So the choices we've most often made is to just, you know, take a different interaction that has some similarity to the Coulomb interaction so that we're sort of dealing with the same kinds of challenges we might ultimately tackle in 3D and, you know, might behave the same way when you're thinking about, you know, behavior of things like density functional theory, which was one of our goals of studying. So the two choices we made were either to take just an exponential interaction because it has a lot of technical advantages for us in terms of how our codes work and everything. And you can even choose the parameters of the exponential to sort of match a Coulomb interaction at sort of intermediate distances. That's one thing that we do. That's what we're doing most often now in these kinds of problems. But also you can take a soft Coulomb interaction, which is just an interaction that goes like 1 over x at long distances, and then it's just rounded off at short distances, so you don't have any of these issues. So that's just what we do. Now you have to think about, when I say applying DMRG in the continuum, we're going to hear shortly in a bit about some newer, more kind of sophisticated methods to really rethink tensor networks for continuum problems. But here I'm just talking about taking an already existing DMRG code and saying what, you know, what's kind of like some minimal changes we'd have to make for the output of this code to be, you know, properties of a continuum system. So here I mean discretizing, meaning we have to discretize the continuum in some way. And the first thing that comes to mind when you think of discretizing the continuum is to use a basis set. So that just means that instead of having this, you know, infinite Hilbert space of the continuum, you say, let's just imagine the electrons are created and destroyed not at, you know, points in space, but in and out of these basis functions. So you introduce basis functions phi n of x. Here I'm just drawing a particle in a box because it's sort of easy to draw, but just to give you an idea. And then you take the different terms in your Hamiltonian and you just transform them to be written in terms of these new operators cn. And just to show you how that goes, I'm sure it's familiar to many of you. For example, the kinetic energy part of the Hamiltonian just becomes a term like this that you know, that just looks like hopping, basically. So it just looks like electrons kind of hop in and out of these different orbitals. The one that's really important to think about, because this is where a lot of the challenges lie in using a basis set, is what happens to the interactions, right? So they have this nice simple form in real space, but then when you transform into a basis set, the most general thing that can happen, and often does happen, is that you get this kind of four operator term, C dagger, CC, with this these coefficients that are some general, you know, four index tensor, and this thing is pretty big. And so that's not so good, because in the way that DMRG is gonna see the problem, this is some kind of, you know, not local thing. It's gonna have processes that connect and that can, you know, move electrons very far away in this kind of 1D lattice that DMRG sees when it runs. So there's a lot of disadvantages here that are gonna hurt DMRG. So basically, a loss of locality. Also, just setting the problem up is tough, especially if you go to 3D. You have to compute all these integrals to get the problem set up. You have to compute these T's and V's. But it is nice in that it's kind of simple to think about, and it's sort of what, you know, simply defined, and it's variational. So it's something to think about. But there's another approach you can take, which is to, you know, not so much go into a space of functions, but think about sampling the continuum with a fine grid. So putting down a bunch of points with some spacing A that you think of as, you know, finite but small, and then you're gonna do a series of calculations just taking A smaller and smaller and smaller and see if things converge. And if they converge, you know, you've gotten the continuum result that way. Or you're gonna try to keep A fixed, but, you know, change how you do the grid approximation of your Hamiltonian to sort of suppress this finite grid errors that might be there. So one really interesting thing about going to a grid is that you have some freedom in how to do it. So mostly that freedom is in how you do the kinetic energy. So one thing you can do is you can just take, in all cases what you do is you take the second derivative in the continuum and you use some kind of, you know, finite difference approximation for it. But there's different ways to take these finite difference approximations. One would be that you would just take this simplest one, which you know, could be correct for like a quadratic function, but could, you know, fail for functions that have higher you know, higher powers in them in the series. But then you can also take ones that have further range hopping and a different set of coefficients, which have an even better scaling with the grid spacing A, and can sort of get the right second derivative even for, you know, things up to like you know, x to the 4. So that's what you do, and you have a bunch of different choices. You can also do finite difference approximations based on families of wavelets. There's a lot of freedom here. The downside of doing this is that in all cases you get a large energy scale in your problem. So you get some coefficient in front that goes as 1 over your grid spacing squared. And so you're introducing a large energy scale into the problem, and I'll tell you a little bit more about dealing with that in a minute. A really nice thing about working on a grid, though, is that the simplicity of your interactions in continuous space remains when you go to the grid. So if you have a short range or sort of, you know, rapidly decaying interactions in continuous real space, you still get that on the grid. So you still get basically the same function on the grid, just sampled at some points. And so, you know, it's still a challenge to deal with longer range interactions in DMRG, but at least it's not gone to where it's just totally, you know, non-local and you have processes hopping electrons everywhere in your kind of 1D lattice as DMRG sees it. So those are the advantages. You get a a Hamiltonian that's still quasi-local, you know, kind of finite range. You don't really have to do anything to set up the problem. You just basically translate it into this discretized form. One issue is that it may not be variational. It depends on how you set it up. But most setups, it's not variational. But it's highly controlled. You just take the grid spacing smaller and smaller, and you extrapolate things. And so you can still work just fine. So this is the choice that we made in these 1D studies. And then I'm going to tell you how we sort of also recently have been plugging this into 3D problems. And we can think about, you know, why really between basis set and grid, why grid is really a good choice for DMRG, right? So we're thinking about 1D systems, and DMRG has this key property that it exploits the area law, exploits the fact that when the Hamiltonian is local and sort of finite range, that ground states have a limited amount of entanglement. And so DMRG scales linearly or nearly linear for systems as long as we keep the Hamiltonian local. So that's a really important thing we want to keep. Also, you know, we have this freedom of using higher order grid approximations, which makes the kinetic energy term, you know, a little more long range. It makes things go a little more slowly, but we can really get the grid error to be very small. And then, as I mentioned, the long range interactions retain this nice sort of simple form that makes them still pretty easy to deal with as long as you use some advanced DMRG tricks and things. Yeah. Sorry?
You haven't done it. This is local because you have the long range interactions.
Yeah, so I didn't mean, so this is, it's tricky to say what words to use, right? Because if you say, like, you know, long range, that means sort of one thing to one community and another thing to another community and local. So all I mean here is it's like not non-local. That's all I mean, right? So it's just as long as the interactions and things are decaying quickly enough, things behave reasonably well. You may have like log corrections and other issues, but basically, most of the nice performance of DMRG still goes through, and you're not getting like a volume law of entanglement or something just really awful. That's basically what I mean. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then so you do just run into one major problem right away though with the grid, but it's something that we have ways of dealing with. And I mentioned this before, it's basically that you get this kind of artificial energy scale into your Hamiltonian. So when you have this small grid spacing going to zero, you have this number in front of your, you know, effective what looks like a hopping term if this was a lattice model, but it's really a approximation to the second derivative. You get this number just blowing up bigger and bigger and bigger. And so that can slow down convergence a lot because, you know, not only do you now have this huge Hilbert space of these many fine grid points, but you also have this really large energy scale. And if you start in a poor initial state, this can really hurt the convergence of different, you know, kind of iterative numerical methods. And I'll show you a video in a second to convince you of that. But just, you know, without spending a lot of time discussing it, we can handle this. And it's a challenge, and it's just a challenge that we take on, and we've come up with ways of dealing with, and there's probably still yet better ways out there to deal with. And one of them is just to work really hard at preparing a high quality initial state. So to try to do a series of, you know, coarser calculations that are easier for our methods, which just, you know, give reasonable initial states, which finally we can translate into this final grid spacing that we want. And one of them is this idea called multi-grid DMRG, where you basically do an ad hoc coarse graining of the problem with some kind of coarse graining tensors that you just essentially make up. And then you solve this kind of artificial problem that's introduced by those coarse grained tensors. Then you just apply these tensors in reverse, and you get some initial state that, you know, is a pretty good guess for your final grid spacing that you really want to solve. But then there's also just simpler things like just turn the accuracy of DMRG way down and limit the entanglement in the matrix product state that you can have, and just do lots and lots and lots of sweeps for a while, and then finally turn up the accuracy at the end. So, you know, you mix all these together and you come up with techniques depending on how hard your problem is and what you want to do. So let me show you an example of just this one. Okay, and just to show you also what this looks like when you set up a continuum 1D problem on a grid. So this is a video a student made who I was working with, Lucas Wagner. And we just took a simple problem of there's some potential. This isn't really what it looks like. I'm just showing you that there is a potential here that's centered in the middle. And these are two electrons, one with spin up, one with spin down, or, you know, 1D electrons. And they have, you know, some kind of repulsion. I think it's a soft Coulomb repulsion here, and the well is just the same function flipped over. And then we start them in a bit of a silly initial state where they're far from this minimum. And let's see how it kind of navigates this really large Hilbert space, right? So this is really large Hilbert space, and there's sort of zero density in the middle, so there's not many states in the initial MPS that can sort of be mixed together to quickly move the electrons in the middle. But nevertheless, they can kind of, you know, I don't know if you can call it diffusion, but they can kind of make their way to the middle. So despite, you know, this really poor initial state and the challenges of the grid, DMRG is just such a good algorithm that it can still kind of fight its way through these kind of adversarial conditions. And then you can see now the effect of having different energy scales in the problem, basically, that the total density now quickly comes out pretty good, but then it still takes a little while for the two spin densities to get really sorted out, because that's something at a even smaller energy scale. But nevertheless, it works out, and DMRG can solve everything. So, you know, for harder problems, it may fail, or it may just take, you know, thousands of sweeps, and then you have to be smarter about it. But this is just to show you kind of, to give you a feel of there's a little bit more of a challenge here, kind of an engineering challenge of how do you tackle such a huge Hilbert space and you know, all these energy scales that come into continuum problems, some artificial, some really physically there. So that's kind of a fun video. Okay, so then very briefly, you know, because sort of limited on time, let me just tell you two of the applications that we've done with this setup, with this 1D sort of toy continuum world and with DMRG. So one of them was more of a conceptual paper, but it's just interesting to know about, that basically there's this, you know, the most common formulation of density functional theory, which I don't have a lot of time to go into, works by constructing an auxiliary system that's a non-interacting system. And then you consult a functional that says, given the density you have, you know, what potential should you put underneath this non-interacting system? And then you solve it again, and you do this over and over again, and you reach a self-consistent fixed point. And when you do, you know, supposedly you'll have the density of the interacting system, but you know, you make approximations along the way. And one question is, okay, you make approximations, but what if you didn't? Would it converge? You know, maybe when correlations get strong, this self-consistent fixed point could run off somewhere funny. Basically, what we showed in this one paper was that that actually the steps in this procedure, when you go from one non-interacting system to the next, are actually computing the gradient in a convex problem. So it's always going to find its way to the minimum as long as you take small enough steps. And then this was just some supporting calculations we did with this grid setup, where we were showing if you take like some really bad input density, and then you know feed it through one step of this cone-sham iteration procedure, where you construct this non-interacting system and take a step, you know, what output density do you get? And this is just really to show that, you know, you're taking what it's doing really is computing some gradient step for you, and then that can lead to a rigorous proof that the cone-sham equations always converge. And then there's just this interesting thing that we learned in this other paper, this PRB, where the way strong correlation manifests is not a failure of convergence altogether, but just that you have to take smaller and smaller and smaller steps as things become really strongly correlated. So it's more like a slowing down that sets in. So that's one kind of interesting thing where we used this technology as sort of a supporting tool. One place where this grid DMRG, yeah, sure.
Are you saying that then DFT will always converge if you wait long enough?
In principle, yeah.
What do you get at the end of this conversion?
Well, here we actually had a whole inner loop where we can construct the exact functional. So this isn't something you could ever do for like a real 3D, you know, big system. But we used this same technology of this kind of grid continuum DMRG to actually numerically compute the exact functional also at each step.
But when you say step size, it becomes small for some correlation. Can you quantify this?
Oh, yeah. So we added a
small.
We had some kind of empirical. I don't remember how that scaling went, but we had some empirical data showing that you need it. It sort of comes crashing down the maximum step size that you can safely take. As correlations become strong. I just don't remember that the exact scaling, but it might be that bad. Yeah, I mean, it's a good question though. We should go look, but basically it was just an interesting question of principle about, you know, even if you had the exact functional, what could happen? So it was basically good news that it would converge, but it's sort of, you know, strong correlation can still kill you in some subtler way. So it doesn't kill convergence, but it just makes it sort of, impractical. So that was interesting. Something more recent, and I think even more interesting, using the same technology that we developed, is machine learning the density functional. And this is pretty neat. So this is actually where we take these interacting, you know, mini electron, but 1D continuum systems, and then use them to create a training set for a machine learning model of the functional. right? So this is actually the Hohenberg cone functional that gives you a big, you know, the main part of the energy, it gives you the interaction and kinetic energy of a set of electrons just given their density. So that's what they trained. And then you can use this as a, you can use this model to then do the cone sham iterations and loop and get the energy, you can get the converged density. And they're showing here the binding energy curve of, I think, of a chain of like pseudo 1D hydrogen atoms, where they use just 5 points in the training set, and then when they went up to 20, and then the dashed black line running through is the exact result. So they were able to machine learn a functional, which they could then plug into the whole machinery of DFT and just use as a black box there, and then get the exact binding energy curve. So that's very interesting. And then
this functional will have some approximate form, or it's numeric.
Exactly. So it's sort of like, you know, how one of the key things about LDA is that it's some really simple thing that if you give me a density, I can just very quickly give you a number to go and use and take the next step. Same thing here. There's just some functional form that they wrote down. Basically, it's just a sum of Gaussians. And it's just in kernel ridge regression. And they and then, you know, but it's just some weird function that can fit a lot of things that's heavily regularized. And then they train it with this interacting density input, densities and energies from these interacting DMRG calculations in 1D. And then train it. And then after it's trained, you just treat it like how you would LDA, except now you get, you know, exact result out of it. So it's like very interesting. So that's just just conceptually very interesting project that they did, and it works really, really well. And then you get the density as well. I mean, that's one interesting thing about DFT is that it's sort of a reformulation of quantum mechanics, but one where you don't get the wave function. So you get energies, you get the density, you can get certain other quantities, but a lot of other quantities are sort of hidden from you. You know, you just don't have access to them. People sort of like to wish they had access to things like the band gap, but technically you don't. And so basically you get the density and the energies really well. So that's just a nice application that some people at UCI that I work with did also. So I really like that one. So now with my remaining time, let me tell you about now how we've been moving to 3D with this technology. So this is also work, you know, very much with Steve White here. So DMRG is already a powerful method for quantum chemistry, but currently the way DMRG is mostly used for quantum chemistry is very different from that grid method that I showed you that we've been using in 1D. So mainly it's been using basis sets, which I told you was kind of challenging to use for DMRG. And the problem with basis sets is that you run into at least two big problems. One of them is just the usual, you know, basis sets in DMRG, I mean, you know. One of them is just the usual limitation of DMRG to kind of quasi-1D systems, right? So DMRG, you know, it's not always as limited as people think. I mean, it can push very hard for quite a while past 1D. It can deal with long-range interactions surprisingly well if you set things up very carefully. But, you know, ultimately, you're basically limited to some kind of system where you put things on a 1D chain effectively, and then you have to work very hard. We're not going to fix that in this talk. But there's another problem that comes in, which is that when you work with a basis set, your Hamiltonian also becomes complicated. And that causes a whole other set of problems for DMRG, you know, and for really for any method. And so you basically have this additional overhead of having to work with this really large Hamiltonian, and you also have this Hamiltonian that's becoming less and less local as DMRG sees it, and that's causing a huge amount of entanglement to come into your matrix product state in the basis that you're working in. So ultimately, all that conspires to limit you to basis sets that have maybe anywhere from 100 to 200 or so total basis functions in them, and you can work hard to try to localize them for special systems and things, but it's a big problem. So the question is, you know, can we use some of our experience with these kind of toy but very, you know, rich and interesting 1D continuum problems and applying DMRG there to help with issue number 2? What can we do there? So, you know, as Steve mentioned earlier, you know, you might think, well, okay, if grid worked well for DMRG in 1D, let's try 3D grid, right? But, you know, immediately you just realize that this is just a giant problem to tackle. 3D is just too many points, basically. I mean, maybe we'll come up with some ways to tackle that later, but that's not what we're going to do. Instead, we have been trying a method that's been working extremely well, which is to do a hybrid grid and basis set DMRG. And so basically, that's just meaning take a grid in one direction, but still use a basis set in the other two directions. So this is just the high-level cartoon picture of what we're doing, and I'll tell you more about it, where we pick a direction that's sort of aligned with our molecule. So if it's like a diatomic, it'll just be going down the axis of this, you know, from one nucleus to the other, or it could be like a chain of molecules. They don't have to even, chain of atoms, I mean, they don't even have to be exactly along a line in the future. I mean, this is something we'll have to develop, but there's no reason why they couldn't be buckled or sort of leave this line a little bit or even kind of go off at an angle or something. But basically, it's still, they need to have some kind of quasi-1D connectivity or topology of how the atoms are sort of bonded with each other, ultimately. That's the DMRG fundamental issue. So we want to take a grid in one direction, base a set in the other. And if you think about how that looks, the grid introduces, it basically excludes regions of space, and what's left over are like little slices. So these are infinite 2D planes that go off in the X and Y direction, and we just sample the Z direction into these slices. So let me tell you a bit more about how to think about that more technically. So one way to think about this slicing way of thinking of approaching the continuum is to really think that maybe we still are in a basis set, and it's just that our basis functions have this form, roughly speaking. So we have some kind of, you know, orthogonal functions phi and j in the here I switched the letters, sorry, but in the you know transverse directions, right? And in this notation, n would be the slice number, and then j would be which function is in that transverse direction. But in the slicing direction, in the one where we're slicing, we would imagine the functions are just some unspecified functions that are making like a delta sequence that are on their way to being delta functions. So in that spirit, we just, you know, assume or just treat the functions on different slices as automatically orthogonal to each other. We just declare them orthogonal in some sense. And in the transverse direction, we have to either choose really orthogonal functions in the 2D, or we have to orthogonalize them. That's one way of thinking about this. So let me show you just some pictures to help you see a little bit in detail, like under the hood of what we're doing. So this is just how we would actually, one way you could go about making the functions in the transverse direction. So one way is to think about atom-centered Gaussian basis set, where, you know, on each atom, you have a set of Gaussians that can span the kind of low energy space needed to describe that atom pretty well. And then you take those Gaussians, which are 3D functions, and you pick one of the slices, you know, any one of the slices. Here I'm just showing one of them. And you restrict them to that slice. So you just, you know, set the Z value to that particular Zn. You get a set of Gaussians. And if you actually study them in more detail, many of these are linearly dependent. So when you go to orthogonalize them, you get a smaller number of orthogonal functions. And you see some of them still have some of the characteristics the original Gaussians had. Like maybe your set of Gaussians had a very sharp one, so you have some kind of sharp feature in one of the functions. And then you get this kind of set of orthogonal functions. And let me just show you some examples for a real calculation. So this is using some set of S orbitals. So these are functions that just are symmetric in the 2D plane in the transverse direction. And then this is looking at a slice near or at one of the nuclear positions of just an H2 molecule with, I think here is a spacing of 1.4 atomic units. And so this is what the functions look like. And you can see that here, because of the properties of the atomic-centered, you know, basis set is constructed from, there's some of them have something approximating a cusp near the middle. If you slice where the bonding region is just in between the two atoms, you see they're a bit smoother. And you see you have some that have kind of higher momentum in this transverse direction. But these are still rotationally invariant in the 2D plane. So just to give you a feel for that. Let me tell you a bit more about how the whole Hamiltonian looks now in this setup. So you can think of the Hamiltonian, or you can think of the lattice that DMRG sees as being like a ladder, but I want to emphasize there's not a 2D DMRG calculation, right? It's not like working on a cylinder with some lattice model. It's just a way of organizing the kind of sites that DMRG sees. So these would be the slice numbers, and then these dots above the slice numbers would just be the set of transverse functions in some order, basically. And so then you can kind of think of this as just kind of snaking through this set of sites, okay? And then in this picture, at least in some of the simplest settings, the Hamiltonian has three main pieces that we have to deal with. They are just the Hamiltonian restricted to within a slice, just, you know, the Hamiltonian involving terms connecting these transverse orbitals. Then you have the remaining part of the kinetic energy that's in the direction Z. You can call this the grid kinetic energy. And then you have the remaining long-range parts of the Coulomb interaction. So real quickly, the Hamiltonian, when you just project it, there's a big part of it that's just the usual basis set form of the Hamiltonian when you just work in a full basis set. Except here, we're only considering terms that are all connecting functions on the same slice. So this is just this really complicated usual form you have if you work in a basis set with the you know, the single particle terms and then the interaction terms. So it's very complicated in general, and this is what kills DMRG working in a full basis set. But here, the important point is that this is just confined to each slice separately. So this is just a Hamiltonian. This is a sum of little short-range Hamiltonians with a lot of terms, but you know, this only the number of transverse functions to the fourth, where that's just some small number like 1 or 3 or maybe 5 or even 9, but it's not 100 or 200 or something. So this is something we can just deal with, and it's not too bad. Another important piece of the Hamiltonian is the remaining part of the kinetic energy that goes in this transverse direction. And here we can use grid approximations just like we did in 1D. So I'm writing down the simplest one, which is just this kind of simplest finite difference form of the kinetic energy. We can also take higher order ones. And this is a special case where I'm assuming some things about the basis set that makes it simpler for me to show you this form. In general, they might be processes that are actually hopping in between these different sites, but that's a minor detail that we can easily handle. It's still very short range, you know, finite range in this z direction. So that part is also pretty easy for us to deal with. And then the most interesting part to deal with is, and the most interesting part for thinking about the scaling of this method, is the remaining part of the Coulomb interactions as you go to long distances and across different slices. And the crucial point here is that because we treat the functions in different slices as being orthogonal, that kills off many of the conceptually possible into the fourth different terms. So we only are left with terms where we have a C dagger and a C paired in the same slice, and then another C dagger and C in a different slice. So we don't have terms where you have like a C dagger on one slice, a C dagger on a different slice, a C on a third slice, and a C on a fourth slice. All those terms are just excluded in the setup that we make, where we introduce this grid in this Z direction. And so already that means we have way fewer terms to deal with than if we were working in a full basis set. And the important thing is the number of these terms in this tensor only scales as the number of slices in Z squared. And that's much, much better than an overall into the fourth scaling. And then you can then, as if I guess I'm running out of time to say this, but you can then compress this even much more using matrix product operator techniques. Let me quickly show you some sample results. So we studied hydrogen chains, just chains of single hydrogen atoms equally spaced by a spacing R. And this seems really, really simple because there's just sort of, you know, in the atomic limit, it's just one electron on each atom with a single, you know, around this nucleus. But you can explore effects of strong correlation, basis set convergence effects, and you can explore scaling the method up to extended systems, i.e. the thermodynamic limit. So this is a density plot, you know, showing a slice through the axis of the nuclei for a real 3D calculation of a chain of 10 hydrogen atoms. Here they have a spacing of 2.8 in atomic units using a pretty high accuracy basis set. So just to convince you that we're really doing 3D calculations with DMRG. I'll just kind of go quickly through this, but these are some binding energy curves that we made in various quality basis sets. So the dashed lines are standard basis set calculations, so not using our grid, our kind of hybrid grid basis set setup. And then you see when we use our sliced basis setup, typically our energies fall a little below the conventional basis set. Sometimes they're above for reasons that we can easily understand. But often they're a little bit below, and that's because they have a much higher resolution in one direction. So they can just resolve, you know, electron correlation effects a little better. But otherwise, you know, we get very good accuracy. And then, you know, the thing that we're most proud of is that the method scales extremely well in this long direction, in the Z direction. So because of these kind of scaling tricks that I can tell you about, but I'm out of time, but also just because of how simple the Hamiltonian is relative to working in a full basis set, the method can be made to scale linearly for these hydrogen chains. And so we actually can see basically linear scaling up to chains of 1,000 hydrogen atoms, real 3D hydrogen atoms. And then the numbers around here are just showing our energies converging, just showing that we have good control over the calculation. And here's energies in a standard minimal basis set, just using more standard techniques. And you see we reach really large systems and get very, very favorable scaling. I ran out of time to tell you the details about this, but I can discuss it offline with those of you who are experts. But let me just say that that already we had a huge win in the complexity of our Hamiltonian because the number of interaction terms we have by definition is only scaling as nz squared, where that's the number of slices, which is much, much better than an overall into the fourth you might get in a regular basis set. But basically this setup is very amenable for using more sophisticated and recent matrix product operator compression techniques. And when we apply these to this long range part of the interactions, we can always find that we can compress to an MPO where the size of the matrices defining the MPO seem to be basically independent of system size. So it seems just to depend on the form of the interactions and maybe scaling logarithmically with system size, but we can't even really resolve that. It basically doesn't even seem to care about the system size. So when you apply this extra layer of this MPO compression, in the end, that's where you get this linear scaling algorithm that allows us to do these really, really huge calculations. Okay, so I'm just gonna skip to my conclusions and say that of course, one thing we want to do is apply this method to higher Z atoms. So that's something that's a work in progress and we feel confident about. And finally, the nice thing about working in this setup is that the relative simplicity of the Hamiltonian and the kind of naturalness of the setup for DMRG means that we can just straightforwardly apply and port in a lot of advanced technology, tensor network technology, to do, say, infinite DMRG, parallel DMRG, which would be an extremely good idea for these systems with huge numbers of sites, and maybe even more sophisticated techniques from tensor networks. So thanks.
Questions for Labs?
Could you hypothetically generalize this to any dimensions?
Not any dimensions, but I mean, it's going to be tough, right? So even just doing, I think our goals for now are going to be doing things like, atoms that have core electrons, and then we might work up to things that, kind of are buckled away from 1D. Then we might even have things like, a carbon nanotube or something where you might have like a ring of atoms connected around in 2D. We'd be really happy if we can get that far with it. That would already be huge progress from the quantum chemistry point of view. And then importantly, whenever we can do one of these systems, we can deal with strong correlation really well. So we can do these not only long hydrogen atom chains, but we can stretch the spacing between the atoms quite a lot. I mean, basically dissociate them, and our method doesn't go bad as you dissociate these molecules. The way other methods will have to work harder and harder and harder and harder, we don't have that problem in the same way, or really not nearly as much. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks.
Can you actually use your idea of these basis sets in this 3D setting on the CMP setting?
In some sense, all we're doing is just taking our 1D grid or some kind of continuum setup in 1D and attaching a basis set index to all of our creation annihilation operators. In some naive sense, that's like all we're doing. Now, I say all in quotes because, of course, easier said than done. I mean, we've developed a lot of technology. We've thought through a lot about, what's the right, kinetic energy breakup, what's the right way of constructing and compressing the Hamiltonian. So,
what would be the disadvantage of doing it immediately, having one continuous direction?
Really only just that, it ties in well to Martin's talk, but really only just that technology is not as mature yet. The key thing for us is that we can take a lot of existing machinery and just apply it whole cloth, basically, in this, it's sort of, we have this issue of constructing the Hamiltonian, but once we've succeeded, we just take our usual old iTensor DMRG code, the same one we use for just toy, 1D spin chains, and just throw that at the problem, and now we get, state-of-the-art quantum chemistry results. So whereas, the methods are still just being developed, for CMPS, of course, still a lot. But I'd like to see it. It would be great. It would be really nice to see that start to work,
So actually, the point would be that if you want to use CMPS here, it would be really not with two species, but with many species, one per set. Right? So CMPS has a problem with when dealing with more than one species of, say, bosons or electrons, there are some complications.
Is this thing about commuting of matrices and
tensor, for some reason that technology didn't take off so far.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
I don't have a feel for how the resources have to scale in this two other dimensions. So you say you have a basis set, right? Mm-hmm. So for instance, if you wanted to study two quantum wires or three quantum wires. Mm-hmm. Do you know how large the bonding, the physical dimension on each slice would grow with the number of wires? Is it exponential, or is it just because you are using the basis set?
It's not so much the physical dimension in the sense of a single site having like a local dimension d growing. We do the trick of breaking it up into multiple sites.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, in some sense, it's roughly, I think, like doing 2D DMRG. I don't totally have the best feel for it either. We're still kind of getting that feel. One place where you pay through the nose is you pay a lot in terms of the complexity of the Hamiltonian. in some parts of it. You know, the Hamiltonian just starts to have a huge amount of terms, and even just constructing it takes a while.
But
you know,
this is a theoretical solution. So you have
okay.
a physical one magnet.
Oh, are you asking about? Okay.
Is it equal to the number of orbitals, or is it exponential in the orbitals?
So each one of our sites, I should have probably had a slide about this too. Each one of our sites looks like mathematically like a Hubbard model site. It's just always, you know, is there one electron of which type of spin or two electrons? I should have said that too. Exactly. So each one of these sites is that kind of site.
So you're snaking?
And then we snake.
Oh,
and then at least in this setup, the way we have more orbitals is we just have more sites in each one of these slices going. So sort of like
no,
having a transverse.
There's no translation invariance.
There can be in the z direction. Mm-hmm. In this direction,
but
there can be.
But the period will be larger because we have several degrees.
Oh. Yes.
It's not a standard Hubbard model.
It's like it has a unit
moderated.
Cell. Has a unit cell. Yeah, that kind of translation invariance. Yes. So,
can I just comment?
Please,
an interesting question. Mm-hmm. So if you had like parallel chains of atoms, then you would get an exponential scaling in the bond dimension with the number of chains. It would be like, you know, independent Hubbard chains or something. And another question is, suppose you just try to go closer to the continuum by pouring in more functions, but it's still describing the same chain.
Mm-hmm.
How does the entanglement grow when you just have sort of more completeness? And there's some growth that we don't really understand there. As you add more completeness, there's sort of a better resolution of these cusps, what do you like, like on interaction, that has some growth, but we don't understand it. It's not nearly as big as if they were independent chains.
And it's not nearly as big as if you work in a basis set either. It's like we still are kind of mostly in real space in some sense. So we still benefit from kind of area law or corrections to area law versus just this VIJKL getting more and more and more non-local form of the Hamiltonian, which blows up the bond dimension of the MPS a lot. We don't have that problem as much, nearly as much.
Okay,
yeah.
We should probably call it there.
Thanks.
Go on to the next speaker.